This is a special report on the bombing of Pan Am 103 from American Radio Works. I'm Bill Buesenberg. Investigators involved in the Lockerbie case say solid evidence led to the indictment of the two Libyans scheduled to face trial this spring. But if the evidence that's been made public is any indication, prosecutors may have trouble getting a conviction. John Biewen continues our report, Shadow Over Lockerbie. The alleged bombers, Abdel Basset Megrahi and Al-Amin Fima, were both managers at Libya Arab Airlines in Malta in 1988. Prosecutors won't talk about their evidence against the two. British law bans public discussion of a pending criminal case. The U.S. Justice Department says the indictment speaks for itself. Defense attorneys, too, are forbidden under British law to talk publicly. The defendants insist they're innocent. They spoke with an American filmmaker in the early
1990s.
I didn't see my presence in Malta as a chance to participate in the terrorist acts they've accused me of.
A whole nation has unjustly accused me. I don't know why.
In the years since the indictment, several top British legal experts have suggested the evidence against the two Libyans appears weak. Others advise caution. John Grant is a Scottish legal scholar, until recently a dean at Glasgow University.
We haven't yet heard one word of testimony, and it's always very easy to debunk evidence in advance of a trial. The Crown, I know, is confident about its case. It cited something in the region of 1,000 witnesses, so I would reserve judgment on the strength of the evidence until after that evidence is in.
That said, a close look at the evidence that investigators have touted over the years suggests the prosecution case may be a hard one to prove. In press conferences, interviews, and government fact sheets, U.S. and British officials have consistently highlighted a few pieces of physical evidence and testimony as proof the two Libyans are guilty. First, the fragment of plastic circuit board found in the Scottish forest. At the press conference announcing the indictment, then Assistant Attorney General Robert Mueller said investigators determined it came from the timer that triggered the bomb.
Further investigation disclosed that this particular timer was one of 20 that had been sold in 1985 to intelligence officers from the JSO.
The JSO is the Libyan Intelligence Service. But behind the scenes, the man who allegedly sold the timer to the Libyans was making a different claim. Early in the Lockerbie investigation, Swiss electronics manufacturer Edwin Ballier told police he had sold timers like the one found at Lockerbie only to Libya. But later, Ballier said he'd been reminded that he'd sold similar prototypes elsewhere. At his office in Zurich, Edwin Ballier rifles through documents until he finds what he's looking for. He says it's a blown-up photograph of the timer fragment that Tom Thurman displayed on TV. And he now says he's certain it's not from the batch he sold to Libya.
This fragment of printed circuit board is from a prototype timer. I took those timers to what was then East Germany.
Ballier says he sold the prototypes to the East German secret police, the Stasi. The Stasi supplied a variety of terrorist groups, including the early suspects in Lockerbie, the PFLP-GC, says the former CIA official Canestraro. At the same time, Canestraro says Ballier can't be trusted to give an honest opinion on who bought his timer and used it to blow up Pan Am 103.
Given the fact that he has an investment with the Libyans, that he's been a supplier of devices that are only used for lethal purposes, and the fact that he has provided cover facilities for Libyan intelligence, I don't know how much you can believe, Mr. Borghe.
A source close to the defense team who spoke on the condition he not be named says, forget the claims and counterclaims. Even if the Libyan government did buy the timer in 1985, the defense will argue, that does not link the two Libyan defendants directly to the bomb that destroyed the Pan Am jet 3 years later. A more direct piece of evidence is the clothing recovered from the bomb suitcase in Lockerbie and traced to the shop here on Malta. The indictment says the Libyan defendant, Megrahi, bought those clothes. But that claim appears to rely on an ambiguous statement from the shopkeeper, Tony Gauci. Remember, Gauci once said convicted terrorist Mohammed Abu Taub looked like the shopper. But 11 months later, according to Scottish police records, in February of 1991, detectives showed Gauci a photo of the Libyan Megrahi. The police transcript quotes Gauci as saying,
"He would perhaps have to look about 10 years or more older, and he would look like the man who bought the clothes. I can only say that of all the photographs I've been shown, this photograph is the only one really similar to the man who bought the clothing, if he was a bit older, other than the one my brother showed me."
That last remark is an apparent reference to the earlier suspect, Taub. We went to ask Tony Gauci who he really thinks bought those clothes, but Gauci long ago stopped talking to reporters.
Bye-bye, I tell you, bye-bye, don't come anymore, eh?
I've come back to ask you if you...
Don't make me nervous, don't come anymore.
Independent legal experts say Gauci probably won't be much use to the prosecution in the Netherlands. When asked about apparent weaknesses in the evidence against the Libyans, former investigators have often said, just wait, there's an eyewitness, a Libyan defector who knew the defendants in Malta. The former British intelligence official, David Shaler, said the defectors saw one or both of the Libyan defendants at the Malta airport carrying a bag like the one that contained the bomb.
There was a witness under the witness protection scheme in the US who's given a witness statement talking about Megrahi and FEMA bringing off a brown Samsonite suitcase the morning before the attack. This guy worked in the Libyan Arab Airlines office. He had every reason to know these things.
But two sources with access to the defense team's pre-trial statements told us that in the run-up to the trial, the eyewitnesses' claims have turned out to be vague and not very damning. The sources say in a recent deposition with defense lawyers, the witness could only say he saw a man, possibly the defendant Megrahi, carrying a suitcase in the Malta airport sometime in December 1988. Finally, the prosecution's claim that the Lockerbie bomb was first planted on a plane in Malta appears open to question. As evidence for the Malta connection, Shaler cites a Frankfurt airport baggage list from the day of the bombing in December 1988.
When Scottish police did pick up evidence indicating that the bomb may have been put on the plane in Malta, it was only at that point the German police actually admitted that they had a piece of paper, a computer printout, saying an unaccompanied piece of luggage was transferred from flight KM-180 into flight PA-103A, which took off from Frankfurt.
That is, he says, a bag was transferred from the Maltese jet to the Pan Am plane that flew on to London. But an internal FBI memo from October of 1989 said to draw that conclusion from the airport baggage record, quote, while not patently incorrect, is misleading. The memo from the FBI's office in Bonn says the baggage list gives no concrete indication that any bag, let alone one carrying a bomb, was transferred from the Air Malta flight to the Pan Am plane. The German government also looked into what happened at the Frankfurt airport the day Pan Am 103 exploded. An investigating magistrate issued a report saying there was no evidence a bag was switched from the Air Malta flight to the Pan Am plane. The German government suspended proceedings against the Libyan suspects in 1992, citing a lack of evidence. One expert on Middle East terrorists says he finds the very notion that the Lockerbie bomb started its journey in Malta implausible. Noel Cook was chief of counterterrorism for the U.S. Defense Department from 1981 to 1986. Cook says terrorists who wanted to blow up a plane over the North Atlantic would not plant the bomb nearly 1,000 miles away and rely on two luggage transfers by airline workers.
I can tell you this much that I know about terrorism. It's simple. You don't complicate life. Life's complicated enough as it is. If you've got a target, you want to get as close as you can to it, and you don't go through a series of permutations that provide opportunities for failure, that provide opportunities for discovery. It doesn't work that way.
Shaler, the former British intelligence agent, counters that the Pan Am terrorists might have routed the bomb on three planes to make its origin harder to trace. Former Lockerbie investigators like Vincent Canestraro insist the Libyans will be proven guilty at the trial. At the same time, Canestraro says the evidence implicating Iran and the Syria-based PFLP-GC still looks compelling, too.
I do think the Libyans carried out, but I believe more it was a handoff from the PFLP-GC after their own operational cell was compromised.
Canestraro says the Bush administration's conclusion back in 1991 that the PFLP-GC was not involved in Lockerbie presupposed too many coincidences.
The U.S. Justice Department, in its indictments, contends that these were two separate, independent operations and not known to each other. That's always seemed a bit difficult to accept, that two major terrorist groups were targeting the same airliner out of the same location, Frankfurt, Germany, at the same time.
And that both hid their bombs in Toshiba cassette players and placed them in brown Samsonite suitcases. So if the question is, who conspired to blow up Pan Am 103? Iran? Syria? The PFLP-GC? Or Libya? Canestraro's answer is, maybe all of the above. Revelle, the former head of the FBI's Lockerbie investigation, says he agrees that's possible.
The ultimate perpetrator in this crime has not been fully established. There's absolutely no way in my mind that the two Libyans would have acted without the direct authority of Gaddafi. But there is also the very strong possibility that Gaddafi himself could have been acting on behalf of the Iranians.
Revelle and Canestraro say prosecutors may have chosen not to implicate Iranian and Syrian suspects in order to narrow their case for practical legal reasons. Some relatives of those killed on Pan Am 103 have also wondered aloud if Middle East politics played a role in that decision. The early suspects, members of the PFLP-GC, had close ties to Syrian intelligence agencies. At the same time Lockerbie investigators were turning away from that group and toward Libya, the West was actively courting Syrian President Hafez Assad for his help in the Middle East peace process and the Persian Gulf War. Middle East expert Shibli Telhami of the University of Maryland says he doubts that high-ranking U.S. or British officials steered the Lockerbie investigation away from Syrian terrorists to appease Assad.
Having said this, certainly had the evidence led to Syria at that time, it would have been extremely inconvenient and very, very complicated in the U.S. diplomacy. So if evidence later came that implicated Libya, that certainly would be, that would lead to a sense of relief.
U.S. Justice Department officials have long insisted the investigation turned on just one thing, the evidence. Still, pretrial hearings have made it clear the defense will try to suggest in the coming trial that the Iranian government and Syria-based terrorists were the real culprits. There are also signs that an even more provocative claim will get resurrected in the courtroom, that covert U.S. government drug operations may have been linked to the targeting of Pan Am 103. In the early 1990s, Time magazine and TV networks on both sides of the Atlantic produced major stories exploring those claims. A private investigator hired by Pan Am claimed members of the PFLP-GC took advantage of a controlled drug smuggling route involving U.S. agents to slip the bomb on the Pan Am jet. Government officials vehemently denied the claim and still do. Michael Hurley headed the Drug Enforcement Administration's Cyprus office in 1988.
I can tell you without equivocation that if there was any, and I mean even a smell of government involvement in Pan Am 103, I'd be the first one up snitching on the government.
Hurley and other DEA officials say they weren't running any controlled sting operation through the Frankfurt and London airports at the end of 1988. But it appears defense lawyers may try to prove otherwise at the Lockerbie trial. Two men who were high-ranking security managers with Pan Am at the time told us they've given statements to the defense team saying they were told of a U.S. government drug operation on their airline through Frankfurt at the time Pan Am 103 was destroyed.
It was at a meeting which was a regular kind of forum. It was the Heathrow Airport Airline Security Officers Association meeting.
Jim Barrick was the London-based manager of corporate security for Pan Am in 1988. He says at a quarterly meeting, a couple of months before the bombing, Phil Connolly approached him during a break. Connolly was one of the highest-ranking investigators in British Customs and a 20-year acquaintance of Barrick's.
And it was at that time that he gave me the indication that he had been the British Customs representative at a meeting in Germany where there were representatives of German Customs and also DEA, and where it became known to Phil that Pan Am in actual fact was being used as a conduit or a route on on which drug shipments were being allowed from Europe to the U.S.
Another Pan Am security manager at Heathrow, Mike Jones, says he too was present when Connolly told the story. Philip Connolly is now retired from British Customs. We could not reach him for comment. A source close to the defense team says Connolly has also given a deposition and could be called as a witness at the trial.
It's quite difficult to come back and picture what it was like, because your memory, you allow your memory to do certain things, which is shade out the horrors.
Bill Parr is a longtime resident of Lockerbie, Scotland. He's a volunteer search and rescue worker. He and his dog spent the night of December 21st, 1988, finding and marking bodies that had fallen from the sky. In his Land Rover, Parr gives us a tour of the places he went that night. From time to time, he falters and his eyes fill up.
I hadn't realized, I thought I'd managed to put a lot of it behind, but with all these hills at the back here, this is where the large number of bodies were found.
Parr says one of the hardest things to face is the likelihood that many of the victims were conscious during the last moments of their lives as they fell to earth. He recalls finding the bodies of two young women in a field, still strapped to their seats, their arms wrapped tightly around one another, and their fingers crossed. Jane and Jim Swire spend their summers on Scotland's Isle of Skye, a couple of hundred miles from where their daughter died over Lockerbie. The Swires' summer home overlooks windswept coastland dotted with sheep, Highland cattle, and crofts, small stone houses painted white. Jane Swire says her daughter loved Skye.
Whenever I see the sea sparkling and the mountains purple and the sky shot with tangerine and blue, I think, well, Flora should be seeing this. She should be here to enjoy this with her family. And I knew she never can. And that just highlights, endorses the cruelty and the sadness.
The Swires say if the two Libyan defendants really killed their daughter and 269 other people, they hope that will become clear at the trial. But Jim Swire says his grief is made worse by a suspicion that the main culprits behind the bombing are getting away.
Overwhelmingly, the one thing that matters and keeps coming to the surface is our loss, and more importantly, Flora's loss. She lost her the rest of her life. We've lost her lovely company for the rest of our lives. But yes, the failure to get to the root of it has kept my anger burning.
The Lockerbie bombing has been called the world's biggest unsolved murder. Some who lost loved ones on Pan Am 103 say they're afraid that won't change, no matter what the verdict in the Netherlands. With Ian Ferguson, I'm John Bewin.
Still to come, an interview with the legal scholar who helped break the stalemate and make the upcoming trial possible, and a conversation about the case from the U.S. government's perspective. I'm Bill Buesenberg. This is Shadow Over Lockerbie from American Radio Works and NPR, National Public Radio. You can find out more about the Lockerbie investigation online at AmericanRadioWorks.org. You'll find photographs of the disaster and of some of the people in this report. You'll also find more details on the evidence in the case, along with maps, documents, and links to other Lockerbie sites. All that plus the complete audio of this special report. Point your browser to AmericanRadioWorks.org. Major funding for American Radio Works is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, with additional support from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. American Radio Works is the national documentary unit of Minnesota Public Radio, in cooperation with NPR, National Public Radio.